shooting out sparks over 38 states, the Canadian plains, and the tequila fields of Mexico.
A program most deserving of a grand introduction.
The Nocturnal Journal.
The Talk of the Town. WGN Radio 720.
With your guide, Dave Hoekstra.
Daytime turns me off and I don't mean maybe. 9 to 5 ain't taking me where I'm bound. When it's done,
thanks for hanging around tonight. It's Dave Hoekstra with Nocturnal Journal. 10:30 hour tonight, we're going to have Daryl Curley Jones, country music bus driver, who's retiring after 50 years of driving around country music stars without an accident. We're going to begin the segment with something we've been working on all summer, about Margie's Candies and the Beatles. And it's, did the Beatles really go to Margie's Candies in the Logan Square neighborhood here in Chicago? It's a story I've written about. I took my nephew there a couple years ago at Christmas time, and we saw the Beatles shrine, and we were all so impressed. Chuck Gunderson is on the phone. Chuck wrote this great set of coffee table books called Some Fun Tonight, The Backstage Story of How the Beatles Rocked America, the Historic Tours of 1964 to 66. How you doing, Chuck?
Hey, great, Dave. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Okay, you're there. Peter Poulos from Margie's.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I want Peter, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And then we also have Stuart Wolf. Stuart, are you there?
Hey, Dave. I'm here.
And your father did publicity for this 1965 tour when they came to Chicago.
Yes, that's correct.
And they may or may not have gone to Margie's.
Yes, that's correct as well.
And I think we're going to have in a minute here, we're going to have John Grachowski, my longtime friend from the Chicago Sun-Times. Are you there, John? Well, John will be with us in a minute. We'll start off with Chuck to state his case. So, Chuck, you and I have been in contact all summer about the research you've done. You kind of are kind of skeptical if they ever went to Margie's. So talk about that.
Yeah, so I wrote this two-volume set on the three tours the Beatles did from 64 to 66 in North America. And, just for the record, in the book, it does state that the Beatles did go to Margie's Candies. And as a matter of fact, Chuck Gunderson himself went to Margie's Candy for the first time 2 weeks ago. And Peter, that is great ice cream, especially the hot fudge. I loved it.
Thank you very much.
It got me thinking, like, did they really go there? Because it kind of stemmed from another research case I was doing on another Beatles sighting in Baltimore in 1964. And so I started kind of re-researching things that I had done in the book. And with the Margie's visit, I was really looking for primary evidence, meaning newspaper articles from the day, pictures, any kind of evidence that the Beatles actually went there after the White Sox Park show. And the earliest reference I found was an August 1987 article in the Chicago Reader by a writer by the name of Adam Langer, who sat down with Margie herself before she passed away and spoke about the Beatles' visit there. And that's what got me started. And I'm like 50% there, if they did or didn't. So let's talk.
Peter.
Yes.
Talk about the Beatles coming to Margie's, and especially the connection with the Ludwig Drum Factory.
Well, let me start this way. I was at the store working one night, and the gentleman walked in wearing a beige leather hat and a vest. And I looked at him, I said, "Hi, Paul, how are you?" He says, "Hi." I said, "Welcome back to Margie's." And he said to me, "Thank you. Please don't announce who I am to your customers. I don't want to have a ride here." I says, "Okay, Mr. McCartney." I says, "What would you like?" He says, "Well, let me tell you, I was at Cubs Park, and the audience was great. I paid $500 a seat to sit on my stage, and it was a wonderful performance. and I don't want any trouble with tearing my clothes off and so forth. So I said, what was I going to get you? He says, a waffle cone, butter pecan. So nope. I gave it to him with a spoon and a napkin. He tried to pay me. I put the money in a tip can. He says, I hope I see you again. He says, I hope so. And he went out. I didn't announce to anybody, but people were beginning to notice him. He walked out and got in a Bentley convertible. License plate was Paul One.
Oh.
Paul M, rather. And drove away.
Now you're third.
Nice man.
You're third generation, Peter, right?
Yes.
You're third generation there. Yes. What were you telling me about? And John, have you joined us? John Krachowski?
I am here.
Okay.
Yeah.
So talk about the relationship with the Ludwig Drum Factory and Ringo wanting to play Ludwig drums.
Well, what would happen was Ludwig Drum, because they were banking at the Maytag Bank at that time, which was in the building where my mother had a candy store. And he used to come over and have lunch with my mother, Mrs. Shirley Tark, owned the bank, and got an invite. My mother got an invite to go to Belmont Harbor to
go on Ludwig's boat.
It's called the Idler. I remember that. It was a big boat.
Okay, so John, let's piece this together. So she knows, Margie knows Ludwig.
Right.
I mean, I wrote about this for the Sun Times, but I didn't know this angle. Margie knows Ludwig, and Ludwig does Ringo's drums, so there's a little bit of a connection there, right, John?
Right, yeah. You know, the Beatles were huge fans of American rock and roll. You know, and you know, at their heart, the beginning, the very early Beatles are a 1950s rock and roll band with some extra influences. You know, but they loved American rock and roll. They were obsessed with American equipment. Ringo wanted a set of American drums. So there's a fellow in London at that time named Ivor Arbiter, and who had negotiated an exclusive deal to sell Ludwig drums in London. And Brian Epstein found him. They arranged to buy Ringo's drum kit, also arranged for, as part of the deal, that Ivor Arbiter was going to design the logo for the drum head. And it was he who sketched the Beatles logo with a descending T that they still use as a trademark for that to this day. Now, that established a long-term relationship between Ludwig and Ringo, who bought several more drum kits from Ludwig. Ludwig, in 1964, presented Ringo with a golden snare, which was believed missing for a while, but found. But yeah, there's a long-term relationship between Ringo and Ludwig.
So would it have made sense then that could have been a Margie's connection?
If Margie's was connected with Ludwig, then yes, Ludwig certainly could have eased a connection with the Beatles.
And Dave, this is Stuart.
Yes,
certainly, a couple of things. And you know, when you told me about this topic and coming on your show, I started to do some research myself. And some more things that John just mentioned. When Ringo was over getting his first equipment from the Ludwig rep, the rep was starting to take the Ludwig label off the drumsticks. And Ringo's like, no, keep it on there. I want things that are American. So I want to add that point to what John just said. And then also researching where they were located. The original office was at 1728 Damon. And so again, very close to where Margie's is. So you know, so there's the personal connection, but also the geographic connection as well. And then also just to the actual night of the concert, from what I know of my father. And again, I was there. I was very young, and I met the Beatles, and you know, I remember that vaguely, and remember the concert in certain ways as well. But I've also, as Dave knows, I've spent a large part of my life working, promoting movies and working with a lot of celebrities from about the late 80s through recent times. And I will tell you that obviously from if you take today's filter on what Chuck is questioning, it makes perfect sense to say there's no way the Beatles could have been at Margie's. But on the other hand, knowing what it was like to work with celebrities even in the late 80s, there wasn't that same kind of attention and momentum building in terms of people running out to get photographs. Obviously, there are no cell phones to go ahead and grab a quick photo that way. And so it's quite conceivable from my experience and from what I know of that time of the 60s that the Beatles, you know, I know how they left the Akunski Park. I know that they got into their car. And again, these guys were in their early 20s, and so it makes perfect sense they'd want to go to some place they could hang out that would be, again, American, like a Margie's Candies, which, again, they could have known about because of Ludwig. And so from a kind of a common sense logic standpoint, it does make sense to me.
Tell the listeners, and it's in Chuck's book where he this, and Chuck, in a minute we want to get the website where people can get this book. But talk about your dad's role. I mean, how he brought your dad brought the Beatles to the White Sox owners.
Yes, my dad was working as a PR guy in Chicago. He had been working for many years, and one of his clients was a concert promoter named Frank Fried, and he also did work with the White Sox, and he put them together when the Beatles were looking for places to put on their performance. And he actually worked with them on two of the three times that they were here. They were at the amphitheater, and I think he worked with them one time when they were at the amphitheater, as well as at Comiskey Park. And so again, he was, as a PR guy, and my father was also a very easygoing kind of a personality, the Beatles kind of gravitated towards him because he wasn't looking for anything from them. They were comfortable around him. He was very comfortable with them. And so they came back into the press conference the following year. I think it was the following year. You know, they had him. They requested to make sure he was going to be there for that. But he really, he's worked with all kinds of people throughout the years, and the Beatles were always, in his mind, one of his favorite groups of people to work with because they were so down to earth, they were so grounded at that time, and they just seemed to be really enjoying these new experiences they were having and not letting it go to their heads. So he really, again, enjoyed them.
When we did the story years ago, did your dad guard, like stand at the front door of Margie's? Was there any type of security setup? Peter, do you remember anything like that?
That I wish I did, but honestly, I don't. What he was involved with was making sure that they were going to be safe and protected at the performance at Comiskey Park. And so, and this story is in your article, but there had been a big circus at Comiskey Park, and they had what was called an elephant gate that was like a gate that they had to dig an extra, like, deeper hole into, and that was the original way they were going to try to get the Beatles out in case the fans ran on the field, but that became less viable. I don't remember exactly why. So instead, what they did was, that since the stage was at second base and it was a raised stage, they had hidden two golf carts underneath the stage, and so that was the way the Beatles actually ended up leaving the concert, but it was there, again, as an emergency as well if they had to leave suddenly versus when they concluded, and so my father was part of that, and he did leave with them, but again, he never talked about Margie's himself, but it wouldn't have been something he would have raised in any context that I'm aware of. But when I know when you talked to him about it, it seemed to make sense to him. So as far as I know, he would have told you at that interview if he felt there was something erroneous. He was that kind of person.
Paul, are you there, Paul?
Yeah.
Do you remember? Now, you told me the other day you started working at Margie's in 1954 you were 17?
With my dad died.
Yeah, right. Do you remember? What do you remember, if anything, about that night when the Beatles showed up? Was there a lot of commotion?
I was a radio podiatrist.
You were what?
And I was a foot doctor.
You were at?
I was at County Hospital. My mother called me up and said, "You better hurry up and come here. The story's going crazy. The Beatles are here."
Your mother called you up and told you to get on the site.
Yeah. Okay. So I read there was this buddy of mine, Dr. Stiletta, and drove the park in the middle of the street, and the police came. There was a lot of police around.
There were police around.
Yes.
There were police around.
Yes.
Stuart, how long did you...
I came in the door. I heard all the noise and everything like that. I found my mother. She was at the Beatles theater.
Stuart.
And,
Stuart and John, and then we'll get back to Chuck. How long do you think it would, and then back in the day, how long do you think it would have taken them to get from Comiskey Park up to, well, I don't know if you call it Bucktown or Logan Square, up to where Margie's is?
Oh, my goodness. You know, you're talking 1965, and it's fairly late at night because they played an 8 o'clock concert. So and I wouldn't think it would have taken much more than half an hour at that time.
But yeah, that's my best guess. Would have been 25 to 30 minutes. So,
did your dad ever talk about an Elvis type exit where they were like just ready to rev up and go? You know what I mean?
I do know that. I mean, my memory from what the stories I heard was that they did have to leave the Comiskey Park very quickly because they from previous concerts they'd had, they didn't want the crowd to kind of lock them in. So so there was a lot of, a lot of what my father had to work on the planning of was how could they get them out quickly. So, again, those golf carts and then going through the back part of, going through the outfield was a quick way to get away from where all the fans were, obviously, in the stands between third base, around a home, and around a first base. So yes, I think that there was a from my understanding, there was a great focus on expediting them out of there once the concert was over.
Dave, if I may, there was some difficulties around that tour stop because the Beatles didn't get into Chicago until 3 a.m. from Houston, and they landed at the wrong airport. The crowd was gathering at O'Hare. There were security concerns, and so they were told, no, you cannot fly into O'Hare. They wound up landing at Midway and had to bus up to their hotel, which was the O'Hare Sahara.
Yeah, Chuck has great stuff about the mobster connection there.
And the O'Hare Sahara had been indiscreet enough to announce that the Beatles were there. So the crowds were all around. They were screaming. Nobody got any sleep all night. They played shows at Chicago at 3 a.m. and 8 p.m. They would not have been in any hurry to get back to the hotel before they left for Minneapolis the next day.
Okay. Can you all hang on a little bit? Obviously, you heard that. We're going to take a break for the news, and then I want to continue, and then I want to talk about some of your own projects, and we can plug the book. So can you all guys all hang on?
Yep.
Okay, all right, don't go away on Beatles and Margie's on WGN's Nocturnal Journal.
She said, you don't understand what I said. I said, no, 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 you're wrong. When I was a boy, everything was right.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN. And on the phone, we have author Chuck Gunderson, author of this fine book, Some Fun Tonight, The Backstage Story of How the Beatles Rocked America, the Historic Tours of 1964 through 1966. Peter Poulos, the son of Margie at Margie's Candies up there at Milwaukee and Western, opened in 1921 as First Securities Candies. Stuart Wolfe, whose father, Sherman, did the publicity for the 1965 tour that brought the Beatles to Chicago and maybe Margie's. And John Grachowski, my dear friend from the Chicago Sun-Times and a longtime Beatles writer. How you doing, John?
Real good.
It would break my heart if this story if this story wasn't true. I mean, we're living in tough times right now. So to say that the Beatles never really went to Margie's, I mean, people have never been there. There's a shrine for the Beatles. There's Beatles memorabilia. John, you bring up a point that Apple kind of keeps an eye on some of this stuff.
Apple keeps an eye on everything. They are very vigilant about protecting Beatles copyrights and trademarks, the way they're publicized, even to the extent that the event formerly known as Beatlefest had to change its name to the Fest for Beatle Fans so as not to appear that it was Beatles-sponsored. They've never objected to the Margie story. Margie has had this memorabilia display and trading on it for a long time. That doesn't prove that it happened. Maybe it's off their radar, but their radar really doesn't miss very much.
I think Chuck, Chuck and I, we've been back and forth all summer on this. I think you have one really good point here, and then the panel can address this. No accounts from the group's inner circle, some of which wrote diaries of the happenings on the tour. I think that somebody would have mentioned this, don't you think? Chuck, can you talk about that?
Yeah, so for my book, I did about 8 years of research on every North American city they hit over that three-year period. And it's interesting that in the research that in many of the cities, there's primary newspaper accounts of Beatle imposters that were spotted and kids trying to make girls think that they were the Beatles and things like that. Even some hotel managers were fooled by them. And I've been listening to everybody, and I highly respect everybody, and, you know, especially Mr. Wolf, whose dad, you know, brought the Beatles to Chicago. You know, what a great guy. But as I, you know, I look at the evidence, I'm just, you know, first of all, it says they went in with five girls. You know, where are the five girls? There's no eyewitness accounts of people that were walking around. I figured the Beatles, if they would have arrived, it would have been about 11 p.m. on their way back to the Sahara O'Hare, because they played on the south side, stayed on the north side. So it's obvious they could have stopped there easily. No photographers. I mean, we're talking about 1965. This is the absolute height of Beatlemania. A week earlier, they sold out Shea Stadium, 55,000 people. There were always fans out by the getaway cars. They had to do all kind of elaborate ruses to get out of stadiums. Sometimes they were held prisoner in the stadium until they could figure out a way to get them out. There were people that followed them on the freeways from, you know, hotels to venues. And there's just nothing, there's not one other shred of evidence that points to anything that they were there. I mean, the only thing I find, the first evidence I find, is an article written in the Chicago Reader 22 years after the events. You know, if the Beatles were famous and Margie was talking to them, could she not have them sign a menu, give them autographs? Hey, I have my Brownie camera, I want to take a picture. Anything, photographers, journalists, fans, nothing. That's where I'm kind of questioning the whole thing. Believe me, I love Chicago. It's one of my favorite cities on earth. I want it to be true.
Peter.
Until I find that real concrete evidence of maybe one of those five girls is still around, or some photographer snapped a photo, a fan that followed him, anything.
Maybe one of those girls
are on Facebook, and no one's ever gotten back to me.
Peter, are you there?
I'm here.
What do you think of that? He says they weren't there.
I can't say I didn't see them. I saw them.
You did see them?
Yes.
When you got back from the podiatrist?
No, when I was at the hospital earlier.
Yeah, and then you saw them. You said they were there.
Yes.
John?
I might have two people who worked for Margie's at that time, the Zenocopolis boys, Tony and Gus. But they're in Greece right now.
They're in Greece.
And they won't be able to get back to talk to them until after Labor Day.
That's fine. John?
Yeah.
Were there autographed drumsticks?
Were there autographed drumsticks?
Yeah.
You know, they're...
Go ahead.
Not routinely, but did people have drumsticks autographed? Yeah, sure. Yeah, they had everything autographed.
And I thought that there was at one time on display at Margie's, at least something I saw online, that said that there were autographed Beatles drumsticks at Margie's. Now again, Chuck,
I can answer that question. I was there a week ago.
Yeah,
and they are late model Ringo Starr autographs from when he's touring solo now. So we're talking.
Okay,
they're machine printed. I looked at the little memorabilia case. There's nothing in it that points to them being there. But there is a photo of them when they appeared at the Bars Room at White Sox Park when they did the press conference in Chicago.
Okay. And Chuck, from my perspective, you do make good arguments about why this may not have happened, but even though it was Beatlemania, in my mind, I still think there's a way that they could have, if they did expedite out of the ballpark, you know, very quickly, and by being out of the back of the ballpark where maybe fans weren't, you know, suspecting they'd come out, they possibly could have gotten into a car and then been kind of, you know, anonymously going down the highway, like you said, on the way to O'Hare and knew about Margie's. I don't know, obviously, but that's just a guess. And I wanted to add one thing, which I'd mentioned to Dave before. This was the first concert I believe I've ever was at, and I was very young. And one of the things I was asked to do is, since there were two concerts, the afternoon one and the evening one, my dad had asked my mom to ask me to bring some of my comic books to these musicians. I didn't know a lot about who the Beatles were. I knew they were famous, but I didn't know them as a 6 year old. And so I remember, I had Superman comics and I had Archie comics. I remember very reluctantly bringing these to these guys I didn't know, and then meeting them in this room that wasn't the Bard's room. It was some other kind of lounge that they were hanging out in, and they were really hungry to get these comic books. And my dad later told me they had just kind of stumbled across comic books, I believe, on this part of this American tour, and they were very curious to see them and wanted to have that as something to hang out with in between shows. Yeah. And as the one thing I thought about as we're all talking is, certainly, even though they raced out after the concert, how could they find five women to be with? Well, they might have found those women sometime between the first concert and the second concert, and arranged for them to be in the cars that got them out of the ballpark and to Margie's. But for what that's worth,
they had the
just a supposition, obviously, just a guess. Yeah,
they had the Chuck. You're gonna have to rewrite the book if we find this all false. I mean,
I might have.
They
to,
said, I mean,
I love Margie's ice cream.
I love the details. I mean, and I think Margie told me this when I interviewed her. They had the Atomic Buster, right?
Atomic Buster. Yeah, still on the menu.
Still on the menu, right, Peter?
Yeah. And the question I have for Chuck is, when you did your research, Chuck, looking at other places around the country, were there other instances? You said there were people that posed as the Beatles, but were there other cases of other kinds of locations, whether it was a restaurant or something else, that claimed to have a Beatles visitation that you could prove didn't happen? Or was Margie's kind of unique in terms of your research that way?
Maybe fake Beatles came to Margie's.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was in California, when they played the Hollywood Bowl on August 23rd, 64, there's an account of them going to Bob's Big Boy, which is a hamburger chain. I think in your area, it's called Roy Rogers. And Bob's Big Boy in Glendale still has a booth called the Beatles booth, just like Margie's does. And there's absolutely not a shred of evidence that they are ever at Bob's Big Boy. And
it could have been
another incident in Baltimore when they played there September 13th, 1964, where George Harrison, for some reason, was spirited away from the group and had to stay at another hotel because he was sick. And on the way to meet the group to fly out the next day to Pittsburgh, George wanted to stop and visit a Catholic girls' school called Mercy High School and also Lathe Walk Elementary School. And there's actually primary press of the day, the next day, stating that Beatle George visited this Mercy High School. And there's a dialogue or an interview with a Catholic nun. I mean, how could you
okay.
Catholic nuns not lying to you? And this is like a primary example of these imposters that would go around and, make people think that they're the Beatles because they were the hottest thing on the planet.
Okay, we got to take a break. We got to take a break. I want to come back. I want to talk about how people can find the book. And, John, I want to ask you about, why did the Chicago newspapers, why weren't they there? So don't go away on Nocturnal Journal.
The Magical Mystery Tour is waiting to take you away. Waiting to take you away. Roll up for the Mystery Tour.
Okie dokie. I got so many more questions. Let's see if we can do in the next 5 or 6 minutes. I might keep you a little bit later, but I teased at the break there. I think another good point that Chuck has is there were four or five newspapers, John, and I mean, there was Cup, there was Bill Zwecker was probably working for Lerner. I mean, where was everybody? How come people weren't covering this?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, and for them to have gotten to Margie's without any publicity, without any photographs, without any news reports, you have to assume that they slipped the press in general. And it would have been very difficult. I'm not going to say impossible, but yeah, it would have been really difficult. There were reporters embedded with the Beatles for the tour, not only from Chicago, but from other markets. I mean, Larry Kane from Philadelphia was on the entire tour.
Larry Kane did the introduction for the book.
Everybody would have been looking for a new angle, and certainly they would have had to slip the entire press corps in order to make this happen.
Stuart, would your dad had something to do with that? Would he have steered the press away?
As a, as I said, I mean, there would have been a structured time for the press to interact with the Beatles, and I do know, again, based on the conversation he had with you and many other conversations he talked about it in general in terms of that night, that, again, there was this, as I said before, there was a real big emphasis because of something I think that John said earlier, that in other, or maybe it was Chuck, but one of you said that there were a lot of instances where they were trapped in the stadiums that they were performing at, so they didn't want to have that happen at Comiskey Park, and so they had taken all these extra measures to make sure, again, they could expedite them out of there to avoid that problem. And again, as a byproduct of doing that, I think from that sense, it's very plausible that they could have stopped in any number of places without being seen. And I just want to add one more thing I was thinking during the commercial break. You know, Chuck told those great stories about all these funny instances of the fake Beatles showing up, you know, with the nun and the like. But I've worked with big celebrities over the years. I mean, I'm not a name dropper, but the biggest names, I mean, biggest names, biggest actors. I certainly, when they were in Chicago, on occasion, we were overwhelmed with press. And like you said before, Dave, there were times where we would go to a restaurant, and as soon as we walked in, you know, the valet would call his friends, and the next thing we knew, there'd be 100 people at the restaurant. But there are other times where these same stars, I could get them into typically not a restaurant, but into, like, there's a place on the north side called Goodies. And I had several celebrities that I told Goodies about to them.
Oh,
and
the gift shop, yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah. There's all kinds of, like, you know, retro, right, you know, tchotchkes and things like that. And a lot of times when I would take a celebrity there, the Goodies would take a photo to Chuck's point about there being some kind of authentication. But this was, again, when it was in the 90s and the 2000s, when, again, that maybe was more common. I don't know. But all I'm saying is I have to imagine that during the Beatles' time in the United States, there had to be at least several instances where they had some privacy, if you will, in a public place. And we don't know of those things because they became private. Whereas the ones that you hear about were the ones, like you said, where there were the horde of press that were covering them. But they couldn't have, I don't think they were under a microscope 24 hours a day. John, maybe you can refute that, or maybe Chuck, you can refute that. But as I said, from my perspective, there had to be some window of time where they could probably have some level of being anonymous. and Peter, again, was there, you know, to witness at Margie's. So you've got that as well. So
I'm going to keep you guys for a little bit. Is that okay, Ro? I'm going to keep him for after the news, because I want to talk about the book, and then I want to talk, I got one more segment I want to talk about, just Chicago's role, and the role of Chicago radio in the Beatles' development. So can you hang on a little bit longer?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So don't go away. We'll be back a little bit more of this on Nocturnal Journal on WGN.
Everything was right.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN, and we're talking about if the Beatles ever actually went to Margie's Candies up there in Bucktown. Thousands and thousands of people visit Margie's every year, Chuck, to see the Beatles shrine. Some fun tonight, the backstage story of how the Beatles rocked America, the historic tours of 1964 to 66. I'm looking at volume 2, which covers 65 to 66. Chuck, how can people find this book?
Oh, you can find it at somefuntonight.com or your usual places like Amazon or other booksellers.
And when you said you spent 8 years researching all this?
Yeah, I did, because there was, you know, the information was so scant, you really had to dig. You know, we look at the concert business now, it's so grown up, it's a multi-billion dollar industry, but we have to think back in the, you know, when the Beatles toured, it was so archaic. I mean, you know, security was archaic, sound systems were archaic. You know, they were kind of making the blueprint for the concert business. As a matter of fact, when they played White Sox Park, that was the actual first time that the Comiskey Park had even had a rock concert there. So all of this was so new, so fresh, and this is kind of some of the conundrums we have along the way.
When you visited Margie's the first time, when was that? Just a few weeks ago, right?
Yeah, I went. I've been always wanting to go. I lived in Chicago for a couple of years, but I never went, and I really enjoyed it. I had a great hot fudge sundae. But, you know, one thing I did see, which kind of gave me some encouragement, is that in the middle of Margie's, there's kind of like a wall that has all the candy display, and behind that wall is the Beatles' booth, so-called.
Right.
And when you walk on the street in front of Margie's, that candy counter obscures that booth, so anybody walking in the front couldn't see anything going on behind, but if you walked along the side street, you could see some people sitting there. So that gave me a little of encouragement, but I'm just still not convinced that they were at Margie.
You state some good cases. I was going to say that was my question. If you, when your visit made anything change your mind, you know, but so that. But yeah, I mean, everything's replica. I remember that. I haven't been there in a couple of years since we took my nephew. But I mean, there's no real original material from their visit, right? It's all replica stuff.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. Yeah. Then on the website they say this is a direct quote. Many years later, Mick Jagger stopped by. And again, there's no evidence of that, no photos, no pictures. And this is years later.
That's where I get skeptical.
And another site that says the entire Rolling Stones were there.
Yeah.
And again, no evidence, no pictures, no recollections, nothing.
Yeah, that's where I get skeptical. What do you guys think as we wrap this up? Stuart and John.
I still hold on to the hope that it's the true story because, as I said before, unless you were able, and again, like you said, it was kind of a hard time to research, unless you knew every minute of every day of their tour, you know, there is certainly room for them to do things that went undocumented and unnoticed, you know, or mostly unnoticed. And as I said, in my experience with celebrities, and even in more recent times, there are places I've been with high-profile celebrities where they might get recognized once they showed up, but even sometimes there were ways to keep the celebrity incognito and being very much in public but not noticed. So in today's world, even with cell phones and everything else, it still happens, not as much, but as I said, I think it would have been easier even in the midst of Beatlemania for that to possibly happen. And I want to hold on to that hope of that truth. On the other hand, based on Chuck's comment, or who knows, maybe there's a British imposter band that shows up every 10 or 15 years as the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or the Ramones, you know, somebody else. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I hold out hope that I would like this story to be real. I hold out hope that they were somehow able to slip the press and get in unnoticed and all that. But I'd be much happier if there were photographs of the Beatles with Margie or in the shop or something. There's something, some kind of evidence from the day.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
we all hope for that, but again, we're looking at it, I think looking at it from a contemporary filter, you know, John. I, you know, and so as I said, I think it there's plenty of room for it to have happened. The other hand is John and Dave knows, and maybe you know too, Chuck or Peter. As they said at City News, if your mother tells you she loves you, get two sources, right? So that comes from a deep Chicago journalistic tradition. Of
right. Yeah. And I probably failed to do that when I spent a lot of time with Margie. I talked to people around the store, but I mean, I didn't go out. I didn't try to find these five girls. You know. That you talk about, Chuck. I mean, yeah, it's kind of an empty spot there, I guess, right?
Yeah, there's only one possible source, and I actually had a researcher do a lot of digging in the newspaper stacks and in the libraries of all the Chicago publications of the time. There's one possibility. There was, it helped me with the last name, but his name was Irv Cupp's column.
Irv Cupp's.
So he did a column, and so naturally he would have probably, you know, he was everything kind of Chicago going on at the time, you know. And so he researched the columns about a week prior to the Beatles playing the concert to about 3 days afterwards, and there was no mention of it. And then he went on vacation for a couple weeks, and there was no mention when he came back in any of the columns. That was our only possibility, and this was from probably the most researched historian in Beatle history. His name's Mark Lewison. He's the most acclaimed Beatles author.
Well, you know.
And we've been going back and forth on it ourselves, and he also has his difficulties with the visit because his next book, the Tune In Volume 2, is coming out, which will cover that period of time, but he's not convinced.
You know, that neighborhood was more of a no man's land then than it is now. I mean,
it really was. It's a commercial kind of district. You know, I did think if it was in a residential area, you know, the limousines and all that commotion, people would come out. But again, it was kind of an outlying, you know, commercial area.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a little bit rougher than it is today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Real quick, I want to have you guys plug your other projects. John, people can find you in the Sun-Times, Baseball by Numbers column.
Yeah, I do the Baseball by the Numbers column in the Sun-Times on Tuesdays. I freelance around the country. I'm keeping busy as a freelancer here these days. I'm retired as a regular staffer as the Sun-Times. But a lot of, you know, people who are interested in some of the entertainment interviews I did, especially Beatle-related, Ronnie Spector, Denny Lane, Billy J. Kramer, can find those at a blog called JG's Overflow. So Google JG's Overflow and you'll find
that. Oh, that's great. That's good. That's good. Are you going to do an op-ed piece on the Players Weekend uniforms? Horrible. We talked about that earlier tonight. And Stuart, talk real quick about your movie, Game Day.
Sure. I've transitioned from movie marketing and PR to producing film and television, and I have a movie that I produced that was shot in Chicago and with a great Chicago film crew. The movie is called Game Day. It's coming out October 4th in Cedar cities around the country, including Chicago. It stars Elizabeth Aldefer, a very talented actress, and Lil Romeo Miller, who's Master P's son, who some of your audience may know, and their music's in the movie. And it's a story of a very self-centered woman who's got to learn to be a team player and make her company's all-male basketball team to save her job. Our website is gamedaymovie.com, and you can get more information there about the movie. But just was completely thrilled to be able to make such a great movie in Chicago with such a great crew and great cast. And I look forward to producing other movies and TV shows that I have in motion right now.
Well, thanks, you guys, for staying up late with us. Let's do this again if we get any breaking news, if somebody emerges that was there.
One of the girls listened to the show.
Yeah, that's right.
One call decides to talk about it.
It'll be great, Chuck, all right?
Thanks so much. I really hope I don't get any death threats.
No. I really want to recommend them.
I love Margie's. I love Chicago. And the Beatles visited there three times. You got them three times, so 3 years in a row.
It's a very handsome book. I highly recommend it.
Cool.
Thank you, guys. Thanks a lot. We'll be back with Curly Jones after this on WGN.